Blog Talk Radio.
In our hearts we were one, the point was focused on us, and we enjoyed this dream, in and out at our will, saturated auspiciously. Sorry, folk, come down, we are preparing to be with you again. We've been missing the point of who we are and why we came. And as this reality deceives us, we get caught and lose our
Dimensional Healing is sponsoring the Community Love Power Show. I am Yah Elohim, one half of your host team, and I'm so glad you're here this evening. We have a really great topic. We had said we were going to do face diagnosis, and that topic is coming up, but sometimes we have to deal with things that are so relevant that come up, you know, during the days as time and life unfolds, and we want to get to those topics. We'll definitely present information on facial diagnosis, because that's a very important topic. It's very empowering, just like the tongue analysis that we did on Sunday. So you want to check our archives for that. And we encourage you to call in. The number is 516-387-1741. We will be bringing in my co-host in just a few minutes, but we've added a few topics or a few features to the program. And one of my favorite features was the hot topic. And this, too, is relevant. We're probably going to end up having to do a complete show about black hair because it's such a charged topic. And in some of the circles that I move in, I just witness that there seems to be a lack of there just needs to be more education about the pride of natural hair, because that there's a history and a legacy to that, just like there's a history and a legacy to doing something, certain things to our hair to be more acceptable in the mainstream society. And we're the ones who enforce that. So let's look at just for a few minutes the amazing history of black hair. This is our hot topic for today.
The history of black hair, our hair story. The history behind all elaborate designs and hairstyles originated in different ethnic groups in Africa. The first known example of dreadlocks date back to ancient Egypt, where dreadlocks appeared on many artifacts. Ancient Egyptians with dreadlocks have also been recovered from archaeological sites. Socially, hair grooming played a significant part in status and identity in African tribes. It was a way to identify someone's social status based on ethnicity, social rank, age, marital status, wealth, fertility, manhood, religion, and death. Twisting, braiding, cotton or wool thread weaving, adding animal fat or mud and clay were all techniques used to create these elaborate looks. Due to styling taking hours and sometimes days, much like today, women use this time of beautifying as a chance to socialize and form meaningful bonds with one another. In 1444, Europeans began to kidnap Africans of all social statuses and trade them on the west coast of Africa. Many wore elaborate hairstyles. Although the Europeans were first entranced with and admired the complexity of style, texture, and adornment of black hair, something had to be done to rid them of their identity to maintain control and dependency. Many slave owners shaved not only the men's hair, but women's hair as well. This was considered an unspeakable crime to many tribes. In 1619, the first slaves were brought to Jamestown. After being on a ship for 3 months in unbearable conditions where hygiene, let alone hair care maintenance, couldn't be maintained, many of the enslaved Africans' hair was matted upon arrival. The enslaved Africans were no longer allowed to speak their native languages, do traditional dances, and maintain their hair in the styles that they chose. All of the African culture and grooming traditions began to disappear. Slave owners wanted to cut off the enslaved Africans' connection to their true selves. They pushed their standard of beauty, fair skin, straight hair, and thin facial features. African dark skin, kinky hair, and wider facial features were deemed unattractive. Because of this, lighter skin, straight hair slaves commanded higher prices at auction. Due to brainwashing and internalizing color consciousness, many blacks promoted the idea that dark skin and kinky hair were less attractive and worthless. The enslaved Africans were given no way to care for their hair. In the 1800s, without combs and the herbal treatments used in Africa, they were forced to use bacon grease, butter, kerosene, and sheep brushes to maintain their hair. In 1845, metal hot combs are invented by the French and available to the United States. Many people believe Madam C.J. Walker invented the hot comb, which is incorrect. She developed a range of hair care products for blacks and popularized the press and curl style. In 1865, slavery ended, but the emotional and psychological scars lived on and are still evident today. Quote unquote good hair, or hair that is finer, curlier, and closer to that of Europeans, becomes a prerequisite for getting jobs, entering certain schools, churches, and social groups. In the 1920s, Marcus Garvey, a black nationalist, urges followers to embrace their natural hair and reclaim their African aesthetic. He is quoted as saying, "You must remove the kinks from your mind, not your hair." In 1954, George E. Johnson launches a permanent hair straightener for men that can be applied at home. A women's chemical straightener quickly follows. In 1962, actress Cicely Tyson wears cornrows on the TV drama East Side, West Side. This was a big deal because braids weren't considered a finished look for an adult woman. Usually this style was only worn inside the home. Angela Davis became an icon of black power with her large afro. The afro became a symbol for black power and pride. Kinky hair and dark skin is embraced, and the phrase "black is beautiful" is coined. In 1968, Diane Carroll is the first black woman to star in a television network series. She is said to be the black version of the All-American Girl with straightened, curled hair. In 1971, Melba Tolliver is fired from the ABC affiliate in New York for wearing her hair in an afro. This caused a great deal of controversy. In 1977, the Jerry curl exploded on the black hair scene. It was deemed a curly perm for blacks, and the style lasted through the 1980s. In the 1990s, Essence magazine declares sisters love the weave, but natural styles and locks are starting to become more accepted as well. In the 2000s, relaxers, braids, and natural styles are explored by African Americans. Around 2009, there is a surge in the number of women wearing their hair naturally. Many refer to this as the natural hair movement.
And so that's kind of almost to the end, but we get the point. You know, the topic is natural hair, and that's really our hot topic because I just wanted us to get a little insight in history if we didn't know some of this. Most of this is common knowledge, but many of us may forget the way in which the behavior of changing the natural state of the hair amongst black women, where that arose from. Because if you talk to many black women, African American or African wherever, you know, it is just known, because I've had these conversations, and it is just known as is what you do. You know, if you want to be well-groomed, et cetera, then you process your hair into another form. You are not considered well-groomed if your hair is in a natural state. That has changed somewhat, but it was infiltrated by the Jerry curl that was just being spoken of and various other interferences. And we got to remember to embrace our true selves, because otherwise we're talking about self-hatred. So that's our hot topic for today, and I'm going to open up the line for our co-host, Dr. Jatha, is in the studio. Welcome, Dr. Jatha. How are you today?
Greetings, greetings. I'm fine, anticipating the hurricane.
Oh, yeah, that's big news in South Florida right now because the forecast actually changes every few hours, so those residing in South Florida aren't totally sure exactly where it's going to hit, but it is expected to hit somewhere on the East Coast, the Atlantic coast of Florida, so everyone is keeping their eyes on the weather. So I'm so glad in the midst of all that hurricane preparation that you're able to be with us this evening as we talk about superbugs. And this topic actually came up for two different reasons. It was mentioned very briefly by you on the last program. And so it sparked, some interest right there because we actually have done a program prior to this on MRSA when Ma'a was the co-host on Dimensional Healing or Dimensions of Quantum. So this is phase two. We're taking a new look at it a few years later, and we want to see what has changed, if anything. So we're going to start with, I have a clip describing what is a superbug, but it doesn't seem like it's available right now. It's still processing. So I may have to get, put the cart before the horse and bring that up later. But basically, the other reason that this program came up was because of the fact that the UN, in addition to Dr. Jatha mentioning it briefly, the UN had a recent meeting about superbugs amongst governments to raise a consciousness and awareness of the imminence of this threat. So let's listen to that conversation. This is the HHS, Health and Human Services Secretary, talking to the UN about antibiotics, and also she has a little piece in there about Zika as well. It's a short clip.
There is a constant arms race going on between doctors and the bacteria they're trying to kill. A superbug is one that's got extra defenses, extra abilities to ignore the impact of antibiotics. The warning here is simple. The very last line of defense, the last drug doctors use when all other antibiotics has failed, no longer works because bacteria have become resistant to it. At the moment, some antibiotics can already be used to treat this infection. The concern is that it goes global, combines with other types of antibiotic resistance to create truly untreatable infections. In that circumstance, you'll have infections that can no longer be treated, but also cancer therapies and things like surgery will no longer be effective.
Okay, so that actually, there's a technical glitch here, obviously, because that was the clip that talked about what is the superbug, but it was mislabeled. So I'm going to pull in the one about the HHS, and we'll see if we can get that up for you this evening. But in the meantime, we have my co-host, our co-host, Dr. Jatha, so we can just start the conversation with you, Dr. Jatha, about superbugs. And if you have actually seen that or experienced it, what can you share with us about superbugs? What is that? What did he just say anyway? He said it so quickly. What's a superbug?
Superbug are viruses and bacteria that no longer responds to our arsenal of antibiotics. They say that superbugs are primarily gathered from hospital visits is one of the main areas where somebody can pick up a superbug from surgical equipment, that's not sterilized or that's been used. Respiratory things that's been used by somebody. Urinary things that's used that's been used to help people urinate. So any equipment or tool that's placed in the human being can develop superbugs in that environment, in the hospital environment. Other superbugs are what we talked about recently, the Zikas, the Ebola, things of that nature are also considered superbugs. They say they're superbugs because one antibiotic really wouldn't cut the cake with these. You would need a series of antibiotics, and even then it's very difficult to really get a handle on the superbugs. So this is a new phenomenon, and they say one of the reasons why the superbugs exist or treating them is difficult is because of the indiscriminate use of antibiotics by the human population. Antibiotics are prescribed by physicians at will, when sometimes there's no reason why they should be prescribed, and the person that it is prescribed to may not take the full term of the antibiotics. So these are a few things that's attributed to the superbug epidemic that's existing today on the allopathic side. Mm-hmm. Looking at it from the traditional side, the immunity of people are also weak, very weak, mm-hmm. because we've been overrun by things. The plague and things like that would be considered a superbug back in the day, something that just went viral around the world and we had no resistance for that. I think the only people that had resistance to those plagues and destructive things back in the past were the people that, the spice sellers, the ones that sold spices, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. They had some type of immunity from the spices that they sold. Maybe we have to look there for some type of remedy.
And then I would imagine that those spices would be like turmeric and ginger and cardamom and fennel and
yep.
other aromatic herbs that are commonly used throughout much of the world. And I
yep.
would imagine that would confer...
Frankincense and myrrh?
Yes, absolutely. Some immunity. But now, because of the interference on the allopathic side with antibiotics, and I have to caution that statement by saying that antibiotics have saved countless millions of lives. So this conversation or my statements are not an anti-antibiotic diatribe. What I'm getting
Clearly.
At here is that the misuse and overuse of antibiotics has now created a backlash in the form of these superbugs. I'm going to play in just a few minutes a clip about a new superbug that has arisen in the UK in pig, from the pig, but now has been transmitted to humans. But before I do that, there's two things I want to remind us of. First and foremost, you can go to our show page. I didn't get a marketing flyer out this week, but I put a lot of really great images into the show page. So part of that is you get to see various forms of superbugs and, you know, super bacteria, and then you get to see various examples of what can happen with an individual's physical body when they are invaded or infected by these particular pathogens. So you want to check out our show page, which is blogtalkradio.com/dimensional-healing. So we want to look at this Health and Human Services Commissioner or Director Burwell, as she's giving from her perspective, what is the situation with antibiotics and with Zika. But before we do that, we're going to remind you one more time about our Living Foods class that's coming up. And by the way, because we are all about giving back to the community, the first person that dials in to 516-387-1741 can get a significant scholarship who is attending the class. But it's only one, and you have to call right now. So while the clip is playing, when the clip is done, we're going to move on to other topics.
Greetings. This is Dr. Jatta.
And this is Yah Elohim. And we are the People's Clinic, home of on-point acupuncture. Remember, we're the accessible practitioners, available to you via phone, text, email, and social media. Reach out to us, and we will call you back within 24 hours or less. We are so excited about our upcoming Living Foods certification class from October 8th through October 29th of this year. Learn the secrets of coaxing greater nutrition and turning your foods into nutrition powerhouses. Classes include sprouting and juicing on October 8th. October 15th is the classical, ancient, and modern theories of food. On the 22nd of October, we are presenting fermenting and dehydrating, and we are sealing it up with tonic soups, herbs, smoothies, and other delights on October 29th.
We have a lot of hands-on therapy, also an extensive question and answer period after each class, and from this you will gain confidence and self-empowerment.
And all of those who complete the class will receive certification in Living Foods preparation. That's Saturday, October 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th at 10 a.m. For more information, check out our website, thepeoplesclinic4tom.com. That's the People's Clinic, the number 4, T like in Tom, O like in Oscar, M like Mary.com. Email us at thepeoplesclinic4tom@gmail.com. Facebook, The People's Clinic for TOM, and to reach Dr. Jatta directly, dial 786-222-9526 regarding therapies and to schedule an immediate appointment. For all questions concerning registration, location, payment, and anything else, dial Yah Elohim, 561-855-0593. Join us. It won't be the same without wonderful you. See you there. Yeah, so there we have it. And you want to get in touch with us there. I'm with the hurricane coming. I'm not totally sure how we're going to move with that particular situation, but we want to keep it in your awareness because, you know, we're flexible, and if we need to change it because of natural occurrences, then we can do that. The chat window is open, so you can also join us in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/dimensional-healing. In order to reach the chat room, you have to log in. But if you want to just listen from the show page, the URL that I just gave, no login is necessary. Just go to the page and listen live, and then you can also see the slideshow that has been prepared in regard to this particular topic. So we want to take a moment and listen to the Health and Human Services talking to the UN that just happened about 3 days ago, because it is so prevalent in terms of this superbug phenomenon that they called a special meeting of the General Assembly. Let's listen for a few minutes to see what was said about that.
Anxiety about superbugs is running so high that the United Nations is doing something that's happened only 3 times before. It is holding a meeting of world leaders to discuss a health crisis. They'll gather at the UN General Assembly in New York.
A major report says worldwide deaths due to antibiotic resistance could surge from 700,000 to 10 million by the year 2050. In the U.S., 2 million people get antibiotic-resistant infections each year, and 23,000 die. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Matthews-Burwell will address the UN General Assembly today. Secretary Burwell, good morning.
Good morning.
So what specific action are you advocating in terms of antibiotic use?
So there are three things that we think are extremely important to focus on to help with the problem. Number one, we need to stop overusing antibiotics. And I know it's a temptation. I'm the mother of a 6- and an 8-year-old, and I know what it's like when you go to the doctor, but making sure only when needed. Two, we need better tests for determining whether you need antibiotics. When you visit your doctor, they don't always know. And then the third thing we need is new antibiotics, because we have so much resistance, as you said, with 23,000 people in the United States dying every year and 2 million getting illnesses that are resistant. We need new antibiotics.
So what can you say, what will you say to make sure they hear you today? Because this is not a new topic.
It is not, but fortunately, as was mentioned, this is the first time that we've had this global conversation, mm-hmm. and it's something we all need to do together. I'm going to focus on those three points, as well as make sure that people are talking about it in their countries. The attention that the UN will give this issue is going to raise it, I think, in countries around the world.
Can we talk about Zika funding?
Absolutely.
Because it's been holed up now since February. What problems do you think that that's causing?
Well, so for us at the Department of Health and Human Services, we are working very hard on a vaccine. We are working hard on tests to make it faster and easier to determine whether you have had Zika or not. And in addition, we need to do things like support states like Florida, where there is local transmission, which means the mosquito in Florida is passing Zika. Many of the cases in the United States, in the 50 states, there are over 3,000, come from people who have traveled. But in Florida, it's where the mosquito is biting people, so we need to help with control of that mosquito. That's what that funding's for, and it's essential that we have it by October 1st.
But with some of the alarm, perpetrated by government officials to try and, I mean, it hasn't turned out that bad in terms of the infections in Florida, has it?
Actually, in the United States altogether, if you count Puerto Rico, we have 20,000 cases. In Puerto Rico alone right now, there are 1,000 women who have tested positively for Zika and are pregnant. In the continental U.S., we have high numbers as well. And right now in the U.S., 19 babies have been born with microcephaly.
Anthony Fauci, who you know is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says that they are having to use funds from other diseases, other things, to fund the Zika thing. Is that true? Is it really a funding problem?
It is. First, we had to take money from Ebola. And I think many people don't realize that actually as recently in the last months, we've had to send teams from the U.S. back into West Africa to make sure that we're not going to have, they tested and may see cases, and we're doing that. We had to take funds from Ebola at first. Because the Congress did not give us funding before they left in August, as the Secretary, I had to make decisions. And Tony Fauci reflected what I did, which was I had to take money from other disease research, such as cancer, to make sure that we could continue to make progress on the vaccine for Zika. Mm-hmm. October 1st, we're at the end of the line. And so for all of those reasons, the Congress needs to act by then.
Secretary, can we ask you about opioid overdoses? President Obama did declare this week prescription opioid and heroin epidemic awareness week. Overdose deaths remain at a record high. Is there a point that you believe this may get better at some point? Do you think we are turning any sort of a corner with all the attention that's been on it in recent times?
So the attention is making a difference in terms of people focusing on the problem. And there are three areas that we need to focus on deeply in the area. Number one is in prescription and prescribing. I think you've seen the numbers. In 2012 alone in the U.S., there were 250 million prescriptions for opioids. And so helping with prescriber practices, giving doctors tools. Number two, making sure we get funding for medication-assisted treatment. In the U.S. now, we have so many people that suffer from abuse. These are the steps we need to take. Progress is being made. The funding for that will be very important.
Whether it's the painkillers or the antibiotics, overprescription remains a big problem.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we put out new guidelines to try that. You probably saw that the Surgeon General announced a pledge and asking for a pledge for health providers to take a pledge about what they will do to contribute to that issue.
And so several topics were actually covered in it. I didn't want to end that because she was also talking about overprescription of painkillers, which, you know, is another major topic. We won't be covering it, but we want to at least be aware. So, Dr. Jatta, hearing what the secretary has said about the antibiotics, et cetera, she's mirroring what you said a few minutes ago before we played the clip. And we're going to actually, you know, there has been actually a change in the superbug phenomenon, and we're going to look at that in just a few moments. And that is, it's now arising in animals outside of the hospital, clinical situation, and then being transmitted to humans. So that's a new take on the superbugs, and I was observing a very fascinating documentary on viruses, which that's another topic for another time. But, you know, the fact is that life evolves. Life mutates is the point. There's a couple of things. There's a really great video on Scientific American website of you can actually see the bacteria mutate. So they set up antibiotics in a big petri dish. I didn't want to play yet another clip, so I'll just briefly describe it. They set up a 2-foot by 4-foot petri dish, and they put in that petri dish the gel that bacteria grow on. But they also put concentrations of antibiotics. And at the fringes, it was 10%, and then, you know, a little bit further in, it was 100% concentration. Then a little bit further in, it was 1,000, and a little bit further in, it was 10,000, and then a little bit further in, it was 100,000. So they went from a way of having the antibiotic at about 10%. Of what would be a conventional dosage all the way up to 100,000 times a conventional dosage. And they put the bacteria in. And they have a video on Scientific American website where you actually can see what happens and how superbugs develop, because they put the bacteria in the 10%, you know, and practically none died, of course. Then they grew, the colony grew into the 100%, and it continued to grow into the 1,000. But then it started to die off. But not all of them died off. Maybe out of 100,000, 999, you know, 99,999 died off and left one. But that one was enough for it to mutate and be resistant to the 1,000%. Then the same thing would happen. It would die off, but one or two would be left, and they would mutate, and they would be resistant, and on, till you got to the strongest possible concentration of the antibiotic that would not confer major health problems to the individual taking it, and it mutated beyond that point and took over all the gel. So you saw it in real time, and it happened very quickly. So, you know, these mutations can happen over months, years, or probably hours. And that's what we're faced with in this particular situation. The other thing that I wanted us to look at is this superbug arising in pork in the UK, because that is something that is also will be prevalent for anywhere in the world. What we're going to do with the next program, it'll be so easy because we'll have Dr. Jata here, and we'll talk about solutions. What kind of things can we do, you know, to at least boost our immunity? What specific things can we do within the TCM, which is traditional Chinese or traditional Oriental medicine framework? And that's what we're going to talk about, because first we give you the scenario and then we give you the solutions, because it's all about the love. But let's listen to, for those who, you know, eat pork or meat or whatever, then this should be very, very, very important to hear about the superbugs that are rising in animals, animal flesh.
A British inner city hospital. A deadly bacteria has been found in the umbilical cords of newborn babies. It's a superbug found in livestock, particularly pigs, and now it's infecting people.
The doctor was a little bit scared when I say I work in pig farm.
It can be caught by touching contaminated animals, people, or even meat. In an 18-month investigation, The Guardian has gone on the trail of where this new superbug is coming from. We've obtained undercover footage of British pig farms and exposed the conditions where bugs could be breeding. We've conducted independent tests to see whether our supermarkets are selling contaminated meat. Well, these results are pretty shocking, and we reveal how the superbug is already raging in the country supplying much of our pork.
It's an epidemic out of control.
It's a catastrophe because we don't even have the most basic knowledge of how widespread MRSA is.
This is the story of LA-MRSA CC398, the animal superbug, and why Britain could be on the brink of an epidemic. At Glasgow Hospital, a strain of MRSA linked to livestock has been found in the umbilical cords of two newborn babies. This is not the hospital MRSA with which we're all familiar, but animal MRSA, the latest disturbing twist in the war we're losing against the superbug. Scientists who discovered it have no idea how it got there. All they know is that the bacteria has jumped species and is passed from animals to humans, and that in humans, LA-MRSA CC398 is resistant to many antibiotics modern medicine can throw at it. Commonly manifested in the skin, this strain of the animal superbug rarely kills people, but for some, the bug can cause serious and life-threatening infections, including pneumonia and blood poisoning. Its main victims are those who work with pigs.
I was filled up with many red spots with some liquid inside. Almost every single hair was infected.
Highly contagious, the superbug can be caught by touching contaminated animals or people.
You'll have contact with people, you'll shake hands with people. People carry the organism in their nostrils, in their throat, on their hands. The problem with MRSA is actually that the transmission takes place in the community.
Many people carry the bacteria without ever becoming ill. The danger is that they can not only infect others, but the superbug can attack them when their own immune systems are low. Although cooking destroys the bacteria, animal MRSA can be caught by handling contaminated raw meat, then touching inside the nostrils or the mouth or a cut. In a major investigation, The Guardian set out to find how this superbug is spreading from pig farms to our meat and to our babies. We like to think that our animals are reared in the fresh air with natural weaning and minimal medication. But our insatiable demand for cheap meat has given rise to a different kind of farming altogether. This is the reality of how some cheap meat is produced. This man has worked on factory farms across Britain for 15 years and has filmed the secretive world of industrial livestock farms.
I think if the general public were to see, you know, exactly how some of these farms are operating, they would be really shocked. Factory farming of pigs is just horrendous, you know.
His first pig he was dead. No one doesn't take well.
Packed together, often in unsanitary conditions, factory farmed livestock are prone to illness, and diseases spread quickly. To combat this, many are given antibiotics, either when sick or to prevent illness.
We get cheap food because we can treat endemic disease with antibiotics. We are dependent upon the use of antibiotics to cope with these increased levels of disease.
In fact, nearly half of all antibiotics used in the West are not given to people, but to farm animals. To keep production lines tight and meat cheap for consumers, intensively farmed piglets are weaned early so that sows can be impregnated again quickly. But the stress of early weaning can weaken their immune systems and cause diseases, diseases which are treated with antibiotics. Although the use of antibiotics as growth promoters to fatten pigs up has been outlawed in the UK, they're still routinely used, sometimes without proper veterinary oversight.
The drugs that are used in today's factory farm animals has absolutely shocked me. The scale of it is astronomical.
And we have evidence that the antibiotics being used on some farms include those classified as critical in treating human diseases. Experts warn that using them on animals risks rendering them useless in human medicine. These powerful antibiotics can be bought by anyone, anywhere, at the click of a mouse. These are drugs that are only supposed to be prescribed by a vet in the UK. Yet, as our investigation proves...
And I'm going to just wind that down now because we're close to the top of the hour, but you get the point. I'm sure you get the point. So, Dr. Jonathan, any comments, please, on that?
The comment that I have to make is, why is it that in Great Britain, foot and mouth disease started there, mad cow disease started there, and now we have this particular new adventure starting there? From a historical perspective, the corral is where Africans and other people had animals in a separate area to the living with human beings. Europe has a history of, I think, cohabitating with animals far too much. Animals, you know, this is a point that really needs to be investigated. Animals should be really kept not being father, mother, child with human beings. This is incredible. I'm just thinking, you know, most of the major animal diseases seems to originate in Britain, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's definitely something for us to look into. Anecdotally, it really does seem to be the case, all the ones that you just named. And I was having that thought. I didn't quite verbalize it, but I'm so glad you did, you know, because when the clip was running, I'm like, well, Britain again? You know, and I was thinking just specifically of the mad cow because, you know, I have a personal issue. A person in my life has been exposed to that. So that's really fascinating, and the fact that, you know, that there's a continuous arriving out of wherever, you know, of all these different pestilences. Your comment?
Well, you can also see if we're feeding the animals antibiotics, we're eating the animals, we're taking antibiotics, we're really, you know, our bloodstream is probably an antibiotic bloodstream. We don't have something that we would take periodically, and then we would use our own immunity then to fortify that. If we're consuming too much, so I can see that we have no resistance anymore. We're taking it ourselves, we're eating it from the animals, we're getting it in pesticides. You know, where is it going? It's a no-brainer that these superbugs, as we call them, we don't have the drugs or the antibiotics to deal with that. Don't get me wrong, antibiotics is the foundation of medicine now. Used to be for cancer treatments, for operations. But the prescription of it, again, it's the prescription of it, the overprescribing of it again. Why is that happening?
That's an excellent question. I think, you know, we maybe pick up there on Sunday, because Sunday we want to talk about how do we strengthen our immune system. What does the People's Clinic for Traditional Oriental Medicine have to offer in terms of strengthening our immune system? The HHS Secretary Burwell also mentioned Zika, you know, and she started off in speaking on the antibiotic situation, but then she also had to bring up Zika, which is very relevant. And even though, you know, it seems to be most prevalent in South Florida, it spreads. And that's why they were spraying Bronx and Brooklyn. We actually never did get to talk about that, but you can Google that yourself, or maybe it'll come up in another program, that even though there have been maybe 3 cases in the whole state of New York, maybe, if that many, the whole boroughs of Brooklyn and the Bronx were being sprayed with the knowledge pesticide that we spoke of a few programs ago. So what we're going to do on Sunday, we're going to talk about solutions and building up the immune system, boosting the immune system, how to avoid these pathologies, because it isn't so much the virus as our immune system, it's our ability to be able to ward off or resist what is in the environment, and that has a lot to do with, that's a lifestyle. A lot of it, the great majority of it is lifestyle, or you could call it the epigenome, which is a combination of genetics and environment. So what genes get activated in the environment, and the environment includes nutrition, our emotional state, the order and beauty in our homes, and it also includes living a fulfilling life that brings joy. So this is Yah Elohim. We're going to sign off with Bernard Speer, Christopher Columbus, because he was a damn blasted liar. But I wanted to get Dr. Jatta's closing remarks before we sign off. Please.
Spiritual integrity comes before intellectual integrity. I'm going to leave that there.
That's a great point.
You can't
point.
Go to college and expect that we're smart by going to college. You don't know how to use the knowledge you get in college unless you have some spiritual integrity. So I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you for that. That's so true. So this is Yah Elohim, and we're signing off for today on the Community Love Power Show, which is sponsored by Dimensional Healing. And we look forward to connecting with you on Sunday. I think that would be October 9th, and we're going to talk about solutions. What can be done for the superbug phenomenon? Okay. Bernard Speer.
A British inner-city hospital. A deadly bacteria has been found in the umbilical cords of newborn babies. It's a superbug found in livestock,
oops,
particularly pigs.
There's
and now it's infecting people.
The doctor was a little bit scared.
Another technical challenge with this program. That's not so cool. But anyway, let's just... We're going to end anyway. I'll just hit a clip. Okay, is a short one.